Chapter 3. Home began to think of posting us as overdue. One Saturday evening, I being off duty, the men asked me to give them an extra bucket of water or so for washing clothes. As I did not wish to screw on the freshwater pump so late, I went forward whistling, and with a key in my hand, to unlock the four-peak scuttle, intending to serve the water out of a spare tank we kept there. The smell down below was as unexpected as it was frightful. One would have thought hundreds of paraffin lamps had been flaring and smoking in that hole for days. I was glad to get out. The man with me coughed and said, "Funny smell, sir." "I answered negligently, "It's good for the health, they say," and walked aft. The first thing I did was to put my head down the square of the midship ventilator. As I lifted the lid a visible breath, something like a thin fog, a puff of faint haze, rose from the opening. The ascending air was hot, and had a heavy, sooty, paraffiny smell. I gave one sniff, and put down the lid gently. It was no use choking myself. The cargo was on fire. Next day she began to smoke in earnest. You see, it was to be expected, for though the coal was of a safe kind, that cargo had been so handled, so broken up with handling, that it looked more like smiley coal than anything else. Then it had been wetted more than once. It rained all the time we were taking it back from the hulk, and now with this long passage it got heated, and there was another case of spontaneous combustion. The captain called us into the cabin. He had a chart spread on the table, and looked unhappy. He said, "The coast of West Australia is near, but I mean to proceed to our destination. It is the hurricane month too, but we will just keep her head for Bangkok, and fight the fire. No more putting back anywhere, if we all get roasted. We will try first to stifle this ear damned combustion by want of air." We tried. We battened down everything, and still she smoked. The smoke kept coming out through imperceptible crevices. It forced itself through bulkheads and covers. It oozed here and there, and everywhere in slender threads, in an invisible film, in an incomprehensible manner. It made its way into the cabin, into the forecastle. It poisoned the sheltered places on the deck. It could be sniffed as high as the mainyard. It was clear that if the smoke came out, the air came in. This was disheartening. This combustion refused to be stifled. We resolved to try water, and took the hatches off. Enormous volumes of smoke, whitish, yellowish, thick, greasy, misty, choking, ascended as high as the trucks. All hands cleared out aft. Then the poisonous cloud blew away, and we went back to work in a smoke that was no thicker now than that of an ordinary factory chimney. We rigged the force pump, got the hose along, and by it burst. Well, it was as old as the ship, a prehistoric hose, and past repair. Then we pumped with the feeble head pump, drew water with buckets, and in this way managed in time to pour lots of Indian Ocean into the main hatch. The bright stream flashed in sunshine, fell into a layer of white crawling smoke, and vanished on the black surface of coal. Steam ascended mingling with the smoke. We poured salt water as into a barrel without a bottom. It was our fate, to pump in that ship, to pump out of her, to pump into her, and after keeping water out of her to save ourselves from being drowned, we frantically poured water into her to save ourselves from being burnt. And she crawled on, do or die, in the serene weather. The sky was a miracle of purity, a miracle of azure. The sea was polished, was blue, was pellucid, was sparkling like a precious stone, extending on all sides, all round to the horizon, as if the whole terrestrial globe had been one jewel, one colossal sapphire, a single gem fashioned into a planet. And on the luster of the great calm waters the Judea glided imperceptibly, enveloped in languid and unclean vapors, in a lazy cloud that drifted to leeward, light and slow. A pestiferous cloud defiling the splendor of sea and sky. All this time, of course, we saw no fire. The cargo smoldered at the bottom somewhere. Once man, as we were working side by side, said to me with a queer smile, "Now, if she only would spring a tidy leak like that time, when we first left the channel, it would put a stopper on this fire. Wouldn't it?" Apostrophe I remarked irrelevantly, "Do you remember the rats? ... We fought the fire, and sailed the ship to as carefully as though nothing had been the matter. The steward cooked and attended on us. Of the other 12 men, 8 worked while 4 rested. Everyone took his turn, captain included. There was equality, and if not exactly fraternity, then a deal of good feeling. Sometimes a man, as he dashed a bucketful of water down the hatchway, would yell out, 'Hurrah for Bangkok!'" ... and the rest laughed. But generally we were taciturn, and serious and thirsty. Oh, how thirsty! And we had to be careful with the water. Strict allowance. The ship smoked, the sun blazed. Pass the bottle. We tried everything. We even made an attempt to dig down to the fire. No good, of course. No man could remain more than a minute below. Man, who went first, fainted there, and the man who went to fetch him out did likewise. We lugged them out on deck. Then I leaped down to show how easily it could be done. They had learned wisdom by that time, and contented themselves by fishing for me with a chain hook tied to a broom handle, I believe. I did not offer to go and fetch up my shovel, which was left down below. Things began to look bad. We put the longboat into the water. The second boat was ready to swing out. We had also another, a 14-foot thing, on davits aft, where it was quite safe. Then behold, the smoke suddenly decreased. We redoubled our efforts to flood the bottom of the ship. In 2 days there was no smoke at all. Everybody was on the broad grin. This was on a Friday. On Saturday no work, but sailing the ship of course was done. The men washed their clothes and their faces for the first time in a fortnight, and had a special dinner given them. They spoke of spontaneous combustion with contempt, and implied they were the boys to put out combustions. Somehow we all felt as though we each had inherited a large fortune. But a beastly smell of burning hung about the ship. Captain Beard had hollow eyes and sunken cheeks. I had never noticed so much before how twisted and bowed he was. He and man prowled soberly about hatches and ventilators, sniffing. It struck me suddenly poor man was a very, very old chap. As to me, I was as pleased and proud as though I had helped to win a great naval battle. Oh, youth! The night was fine. In the morning a homeward-bound ship passed us hull down, the first we had seen for months. But we were nearing the land at last, Java Head being about 190 miles off, and nearly due north. Next day it was my watch on deck from 8 to 12. At breakfast the captain observed, "It's wonderful how that smell hangs about the cabin." ... About 10, the mate being on the poop, I stepped down on the main deck for a moment. The carpenter's bench stood abaft the mainmast. I leaned against it sucking at my pipe, and the carpenter, a young chap, came to talk to me. He remarked, "I think we have done very well, haven't we?" ... And then I perceived with annoyance the fool was trying to tilt the bench. I said curtly, "Don't, Chips," and immediately became aware of a queer sensation, of an absurd delusion. I seemed somehow to be in the air. I heard all around me like a pent-up breath released, as if a thousand giants simultaneously had said foo, and felt a dull concussion which made my ribs ache suddenly. No doubt about it, I was in the air, and my body was describing a short parabola. But short as it was, I had the time to think several thoughts in, as far as I can remember, the following order. "This can't be the carpenter. What is it? Some accident? Submarine volcano? Coals? Gas? By Jove! We are being blown up, everybody's dead. I am falling into the after hatch. I see fire in it. The coal dust suspended in the air of the hold had glowed dull red at the moment of the explosion. In the twinkling of an eye, in an infinitesimal fraction of a second since the first tilt of the bench, I was sprawling full length on the cargo. I picked myself up and scrambled out. It was quick like a rebound. The deck was a wilderness of smashed timber, lying crosswise like trees in the wood after a hurricane. An immense curtain of soiled rags waved gently before me. It was the mainsail blown to strips. I thought, the masts will be toppling over directly, and to get out of the way bolted on all fours towards the poop ladder. The first person I saw was man, with eyes like saucers, his mouth open, and the long white hair standing straight on end round his head like a silver halo. He was just about to go down when the sight of the main deck stirring, heaving up, and changing into splinters before his eyes, petrified him on the top step. I stared at him in unbelief, and he stared at me with a queer kind of shocked curiosity. I did not know that I had no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, that my young mustache was burnt off, that my face was black, one cheek laid open, my nose cut, and my chin bleeding. I had lost my cap, one of my slippers, and my shirt was torn to rags. Of all this, I was not aware. I was amazed to see the ship still afloat, the poop deck whole, and, most of all, to see anybody alive. Also the peace of the sky, and the serenity of the sea were distinctly surprising. I suppose I expected to see them convulsed with horror. Pass the bottle. There was a voice hailing the ship from somewhere in the air, in the sky I couldn't tell. Presently I saw the captain, and he was mad. He asked me eagerly, "Where's the cabin table?" And to hear such a question was a frightful shock. I had just been blown up, you understand, and vibrated with that experience. I wasn't quite sure whether I was alive. Man began to stamp with both feet and yelled at him, "Good God! Don't you see the deck's blown out of her?" I found my voice, and stammered out, as if conscious of some gross neglect of duty, "I don't know where the cabin table is." It was like an absurd dream. Do you know what he wanted next? Well, he wanted to trim the yards. Very placidly, and as if lost in thought, he insisted on having the 4 yards squared. "I don't know if there's anybody alive," said man, almost tearfully. "Surely," he said gently, "there will be enough left to square the 4 yards. The old chap, it seems, was in his own berth, winding up the chronometers, when the shock sent him spinning. Immediately it occurred to him, as he said afterwards, that the ship had struck something, and he ran out into the cabin. There, he saw, the cabin table had vanished somewhere. The deck being blown up, it had fallen down into the lazarette, of course. Where we had our breakfast, that morning he saw only a great hole in the floor. This appeared to him so awfully mysterious, and impressed him so immensely, that what he saw and heard after he got on deck were mere trifles in comparison. And, mark, he noticed directly the wheel deserted, and his bark off her course, and his only thought was to get that miserable, stripped, undecked, smoldering shell of a ship back again with her head pointing at her port of destination. Bangkok. That's what he was after. I tell you, this quiet, bowed, bandy-legged, almost deformed little man was immense in the singleness of his idea, and in his placid ignorance of our agitation. He motioned us forward with a commanding gesture, and went to take the wheel himself. Yes, that was the first thing we did, trim the yards of that wreck. No one was killed, or even disabled, but everyone was more or less hurt. You should have seen them. Some were in rags, with black faces, like coal heavers, like sweeps, and had bullet heads that seemed closely cropped, but were in fact cinched to the skin. Others of the watch below, awakened by being shot out from their collapsing bunks, shivered incessantly, and kept on groaning even as we went about our work. But they all worked. That crew of Liverpool hard cases had in them the right stuff. It's my experience they always have. It is the sea that gives it the vastness, the loneliness surrounding their dark, stolid souls. Ah. Well, we stumbled, we crept, we fell, we barked our shins on the wreckage, we hauled. The masts stood, but we did not know how much they might be charred down below. It was nearly calm, but a long swell ran from the west and made a roll. They might go at any moment. We looked at them with apprehension. One could not foresee which way they would fall. Then we retreated aft and looked about us. The deck was a tangle of planks on edge, of planks on end, of splinters, of ruined woodwork. The masts rose from that chaos like big trees above a matted undergrowth. The interstices of that mass of wreckage were full of something whitish, sluggish, stirring of something that was like a greasy fog. The smoke of the invisible fire was coming up again, was trailing, like a poisonous thick mist in some valley choked with dead wood. Already lazy wisps were beginning to curl upwards amongst the mass of splinters. Here and there a piece of timber, stuck upright, resembled a post. Half of a fife rail had been shot through the foresail, and the sky made a patch of glorious blue in the ignobly soiled canvas. A portion of several boards holding together had fallen across the rail, and one end protruded overboard, like a gangway leading upon nothing, like a gangway leading over the deep sea, leading to death, as if inviting us to walk the plank at once, and be done with our ridiculous troubles. And still the air, the sky a ghost, something invisible was hailing the ship. Someone had the sense to look over, and there was the helmsman, who had impulsively jumped overboard, anxious to come back. He yelled and swam lustily like a merman, keeping up with the ship. We threw him a rope, and presently he stood amongst us streaming with water and very crestfallen. The captain had surrendered the wheel, and apart, elbow on rail and chin in hand, gazed at the sea wistfully. We asked ourselves, what next? I thought, now, this is something like. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.